world will not tolerate intolerance. It does not like us to point out that they are living evil lives. Now, the subject matter for this class is the life of Abraham and Jacob. And they interacted with the angels in remarkable ways. We have Abraham sharing a meal with three angels and then debating, negotiating with the Yahweh angel to save Lot. We have Jacob wrestling with an angel. And he won. It's remarkable. Now, another occasion where a chapter break is a real impediment to understanding is in Genesis 19. And this deals with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's have a look at it. The rescue of Lot. Genesis 19. And there came two angels to Sodom at evening, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. So two angels come to Sodom. Lot immediately acts to protect them, knowing the evil that is in that place. He compels them, that's a strong word, to come and lodge with him and presents them with a feast. And we know how this unsavory chapter plays out, how the men of the city behave and how Lot has to be rescued from the destruction of the city along with his wife and his two daughters. But minus his sons and his children's spouses. And the very moment that Lot has been moved to safety, God acts and sends his judgment. Verse 23, the sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar. He must have walked all night. Verse 24, then Yahweh rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone, and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities, and all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from him, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, just reading chapter 19 in isolation presents a very different perspective than reading it alongside chapter 18. And in chapter 18, we're introduced to not one or two, but three angels, one of whom is the name-bearing angel. Let's go there briefly. Chapter 18, verse 1. And Yahweh appeared unto Abraham in the plains of Mamre, as he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. Remember we said about stood by? Here's another occasion. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will fetch a morsel of bread, and comfort ye your hearts. After that ye shall pass on. For therefore are ye come to your servant. And they said, So do as thou hast said. So Abraham, like Lot, shows this tremendous hospitality to the travelers. And presumably, between Abraham and Lot, they are the source for the New Testament passage in Hebrews 13, verse 2. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. So these three angels are on an important mission. By the time they've completed their mission, judgment will be poured out on five of the repugnant cities of the plain of Sodom. And three babies will be conceived who will grow to become fathers of nations. Isaac, who's going to become the father of Jacob, the father of Israel. Moab, and Ben-Ammi, who becomes the father of the nation of Ammon. That's included in this mission that they're on. And Sarah, hearing that she is going to be with child at her age 90, laughs in the tent and is overheard by one of the angels. 18 verse 13, And Yahweh said unto Abraham, Wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, Shall I of a surety bear a child which am old? Is anything too hard for Yahweh? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah denied, saying, I laughed not, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. And the men rose up thence and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. So these are amazing interactions between Abraham and Sarah and the Yahweh angel, the most powerful angel who's to be feared and respected. They get to give him a meal. They have a discussion. He tells them things that are going to happen. But is he going to tell them what he's going to do with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, given Lot is there? Is he going to share that with them? Well, he has a certain amount of autonomy. This angel has decision-making powers of his own right while still operating as God's mouthpiece to Abraham. And so in verse 17, chapter 18, verse 17, Yahweh said, shall I hide from Abraham the thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. And so the Yahweh angel reasons it was right to share with Abraham his mission regarding the destruction of Sodom, based on two reasons. One is that Abraham had been given the great and precious promises that included blessings of the promised seed and overflowing blessings of the whole world. And secondly, that the angel could vouch for Abraham's behavior and his leadership in raising his household to be obedient to the way of Yahweh. Verse 19, for I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, that they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment. And so these are the triggers that have wider application for angelic intervention for us. We might never find ourselves in Abraham's position of speaking face to face with the Yahweh angel, but other angels might be tasked to work with us. Maybe this angel. And their work will be conditional on us knowing or being inheritors of the Abrahamic promises and being responsive to the word, keeping the way of Yahweh, doing justice and judgment. Angels are sent forth to minister unto those who shall be heirs of salvation, not to those who are just playing at it or have no interest at all. So we've got to give them every reason to want to operate with us. Now the calling is not within our purview. It's God who calls. He has his very own good reasons for calling. Why you? Why me? Why Abraham? We don't know. We can be sure it's not for any inherent awesomeness that we may possess. We are nothing. We are only special when we've been called. We're only special because we have been called. And if we respond to the word appropriately and try to keep the way of Yahweh. Deuteronomy 7 says, for thou art an holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God has chosen thee, and he's talking to Israel, has chosen thee to be a special people unto himself, above all people that are on the face of the earth. But Yahweh did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people, but because Yahweh loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he has sworn unto your fathers. That's the reason God chose Israel, because he chose Israel. Love them. Why does God choose that nation of all the nations? He chose that nation of all the nations because he loved them. Why does any man or any woman choose their spouse of all the people that are out there? Well, because That's the one they love. And so we're like Israel, being in this amazing privileged position that we enjoy, not for any reason or goodness of our own, but because of love. We read in 1 John 4:19, we love him because he first loved us. In Romans 5, it says, but God commends his love towards us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And in Hosea 11:1, when Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. And so we're called beforehand, not by merit, but through grace. But after he was called, it was up to Abraham to respond to the invitation, and he responded marvelously in keeping the way of Yahweh, and thus made his position sure. And his calling and ours are the same. We too have been given these great and precious promises, the very same promises of Abraham. And so we too must respond in keeping the way of Yahweh. In 2 Peter 1 verse 10 we read, wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. If you do these things, you shall never fall. And so if we have both the promise and are walking in the way of Yahweh, then we can have confidence that the angels will be watching over us, and we may be giving them options regarding how they interact with us. So back to Abraham. The Yahweh angel decides he is going to share his intentions regarding Sodom and its destruction. And it would seem that he is doing so to provoke this response in Abraham. Abraham would understand what God's going to do, conclude that, oh no, that means Lot's going to be there and he's in trouble, and get him to plead for the life of his nephew and family. And we see in this respectful negotiation insights into Abraham's character, and God's abundant mercy, balanced with the need for justice. So Yahweh, after negotiating down from 50, says, okay, I won't destroy the city for 10. Abraham's doing the math all the time, right? And we got 10 in the city, with Lot, his wife, two daughters, and okay, sons-in-law, daughters-in-law. I think, can we scrape to 10? And so watch the angels. Three of them leave Abraham. Ignore the chapter break. Scratch that one out also. Two of them arrive in Sodom. And why two? Why not more? Well, Yahweh knew in advance how many angels would be required for this mission. And two angels means there were four hands. And only four hands were needed to pull what could be salvaged out of that wicked city, soon to be free, when Lot's wife looked back in disobedience to the angel's command. She had been predestined to the promises of Abraham, but literally could not walk in the way of Yahweh, so was included in the destruction of the city. The third angel, the Yahweh angel, has not gone far. And this is where the chapter break would blind us to the fact that it is this angel, acting on behalf of the Eternal Father, bearing his name, that brought destruction on the city. Genesis 19 and verse 24, Yahweh rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. Three angels. This was the angel that brought the judgment, allowing the other two to bring salvation. And so the destruction of the cities of the plain becomes a pattern for the judgments that are to be poured out on the world. Previously, the world has been judged already. You see the evidence of that all over the planet, in shells on hilltops and mountainsides, and the destruction of the world by the flood in the days of Noah. In the days of Lot, the destruction came by fire, as it will be in our day. Lord Jesus Christ said in Luke 17:28, likewise also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, They bought, they sold, they planted, they built it, but the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. And so we can expect plenty more wildfires and much worse judgments in the days ahead. Things will get decidedly unpleasant in the world. But let us who are inheritors of the promises to Abraham keep walking in the way of Yahweh and trust that God will send his angels to gather us out of trouble before him. He says, Jesus says in Matthew 24:31, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Let's hope that we're pulled out before the worst comes, like Lot and his family were yanked out of the world. Now, there were other occasions in the life of Abraham where he interacts with the Yahweh angel. Most notably is Genesis 22, where Abraham is tested over the sacrifice of Isaac. Does he truly believe in promises? Is the resurrection a reality for him? Did he kill his son to show that he believed in the resurrection? Abraham passes the test, and the angel called to him from heaven twice. First, to stay his hand from the blow that would strike his son, and second, to grant him even more promises and blessings and give him further insight into the work of his most special descendant. Now, some of us have interesting stories to tell about deducing angelic guidance in our lives. Sometimes when we fall asleep, right? I remember as a young lad, Brother Alan Eyre was visiting our house, and he recounted to us these amazing stories of how he'd been operating on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And this story stuck with me. I was like, wow, it had to be an angel. Who else would have been there at that time to do that job? It's like an amazing story. And I'm sure we all have stories. I have lots of times when I think, oh, that was an angel. You probably do too. And if you think about how the life of the family of Abraham would have acted around the campfire at night under the stars with no DVDs or Netflix to watch. People do that sort of stuff. No cards to be played because it's too dark. They just had the stars and the campfire and they would talk. What are they going to talk about? Well, Abraham's family had lots of time to talk about angels operating in their lives. Do you know how old Jacob was when his grandfather Abraham died? Well, we have a 15 at the back. We'll take it. Good math. 15, that's an impressionable age, right? That's a good time to be listening and remembering for the rest of your life the stories of promises, the stories recounted. They would stick with Jacob, and he'd be able to tell them to his sons and grandsons and granddaughters. And Jacob's life is full of interactions with angels. He has what Brother Ron Cowie refers to as God consciousness. I love that term. God consciousness. He was just aware of angels in his life. And he may have had special insights, perhaps. In the end of his long life, when he came to bless his family, he says, "The God which fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads." So he wants to pass on his blessing. He blesses through this angel. He wants his angel to continue his work when he goes with these lads. And how could he not look back with hindsight to see the hand of God at work in the events of his and his family's life? Joseph's disappearance, horrendously painful at the time, and then his miraculous reappearance some years later as second in the kingdom to save the nation, including Jacob's family, from starvation. But it wasn't just in hindsight that Jacob could see the angels working with him. In Genesis 28, when he was probably about 57 years old, while fleeing from his brother Esau, he sees a vision of angels ascending and descending from the place where he slept. And this was not an ordinary dream. If you look at Jacob's reaction when he woke, he's taking it seriously. In Genesis 28:16, we get this passage where he says, "Surely Yahweh is in the place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid and said, "How dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it for a pillow and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of the place Beth El. For the name of the city was called Luz at first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall Yahweh be my God. And this stone which I set for a pillar shall be God's house, Beth El. And all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." So he makes this vow, asking that God would preserve him. He would like bread to eat, raiment to put on, and to come again to his father's house in peace. Takes this dream super seriously. This was the dreams that come to us from God are real dreams. They're more real than dreams. There's something else going on. I don't know how to describe one, having yet not had one, as well as I can remember. I'm sure I remember if I had one. These were meaningful. They were like they must have been awake enough that. Act as they would have if they were actually awake. Anyway, he sees this dream, takes it seriously, and commits himself there and then to serving the God of Israel, his God. He makes an arrangement, a deal, if you like. And as we saw, at the end of his life, he said, "Yeah, the angel that blessed me, kept me, all those years, did all those things I asked, please bless the lads." And so, what a nice, easy ride Jacob had of his life. The angel was there for him. Easy. Didn't have any troubles at all. There's no suffering. No. He had all sorts of hardships. Most nights he was cold and wet and damp with the dew of heaven. He looked after sheep. He had to keep hundreds or thousands of sheep in dangerous territory. Everybody wanted a piece of it. The lion, the bear, the wolves, neighbors, fathers-in-law. He had all sorts of trouble. His uncle Laban and father-in-law, a taskmaster and a wage stealer. And you know, when he returned 40 years later to the land of his fathers, or been promised to his fathers, he has to fight for an inheritance. Not even an inheritance. He doesn't get given the land yet. That blessing is still to come. But he had to eke out an existence with his sword and with his bow. In Genesis 48:22, it tells us that. And at the age of 130, when asked how old he was, he says, "I'm only 130. If few and evil have the days of the years of my life been." So being called to receive the promises to Abraham and having angels watching over us does not provide immunity from the trials of life. We all must endure suffering. What we're guaranteed, however, is that God is working out our eternal life for his own honor and glory. At the age of 97, we have a few 97-year-olds. I'm kidding. No, we don't. Okay. I wasn't looking at anybody. I'm looking at the black wall. No, we don't have any 97-year-olds. But 97 years old he was when he flees from labor and he's about to enter the land and he's confronted with this rather unsettling news that his slightly unhinged brother Esau, also 97, he's a twin, is heading towards him with a small army. And Jacob's response is telling. In Genesis 32, verse 7, it says, "Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed." This is a man who's known action. He is afraid and distressed. He isn't scared of dark nights and bears and wolves and lions and all those sorts of things. He is worried. The last he knew, Esau was biding his time till their father Isaac had died, at which point he was going to murder him. In Genesis 24, verse 41, it says that Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob." He was walking in the ways of Cain, who hated his brother Abel and slew him. And the divine commentary on this passage is very telling. Malachi 1 and repeated in Romans 9. "Jacob have I loved," says God, "but Esau have I hated." Hated of God, that's not a good place to be. And we won't go into all the reasons, but he despised his birthright. The Abrahamic blessings. He didn't want them. So we make these points to demonstrate that it was a real, not an imagined, threat that Esau posed to Jacob. It's an easy trap to fall into, to look back on a situation that had been really dire, but turned out well, and think that we perhaps were overreacting when actually it may have been a really valid concern. And it was our prayers that God responded to and caused the angel to intervene in our lives that made it better. So when we're in that situation, we've got to remember, you know, to be thankful for being pulled out of that situation. Now Jacob, in characteristic style, tries his utmost to fashion a better outcome. Is he right? Is he wrong? Well, we can't just pray and do nothing and sit back and hope that God's going to do all the work. Can't pray for a great harvest and you haven't put any seed in the ground. You have to do something. God cannot guide a step that isn't taken. We have to give him something to work with. And that is true. But then the pendulum can swing the other way and we can be trying to deliver ourselves from all evil. And I'm not sure where in this pendulum swing that Jacob was. He made an extraordinary effort to buy favor of his brother with gifts and flocks. But then in the middle of this plan, as he's executing it, it seems, the unusual event occurs that we read about in our passage, Genesis 32, 24. There he was left alone and wrestled a man until the breaking of the day. And when he saw, he prevailed not against him. That's the angel. When the angel saw, he prevailed not against him. He touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint. You know that feeling? As he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. And Jacob said, I will not let you go, except you bless me. And he said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And the angel said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. So, I wonder, what was the angel's intent in keeping Jacob there? Was he keeping Jacob from arranging all those issues, trying to fashion his own salvation? Was he forcing him to rely on God? Did Jacob feel that, oh, my gifts are pointless? I'm giving him a portion of the whole. He just has to kill me and the whole is his anyway. Does he feel he desperately needs angelic intervention? I think he does. If you look at verse 1 and 2, it makes me wonder whether Jacob could always see angels. We get an extra commentary on this event in Hosea chapter 12. About Jacob, he took his brother, verse 3, by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. So somehow he knew how to work with angels. He had unlocked the power of working with angels. This angel was there to help him, and the angel had to do his job. It makes me think that maybe the insights that we gain from looking at Micah could be relevant here. Like the angel had been given under what circumstances can an angel lose a wrestling match with a man, right? And he shouldn't be able to lose, surely. Pow, right? Pow, and 100 men could fall down. So, what's going on? And maybe God had given him a set of objectives to achieve and a set of restrictions that he couldn't use too much power. But he was allowed to dislocate Jacob's hip. Maybe it was imperative that Jacob was not there, and that if he was not there, Esau then wouldn't, like, get riled up and it would be okay till later. Maybe wrestling slowed him down, plus the hip being dislocated, plus now he's having to limp to catch up. Maybe that gave enough time for whatever else was going on to happen. And Jacob, meanwhile, he's determined to receive his blessing. His Bethel test, if you like, was about to be put to the test. He'd be given food and raiment, but would he return to his father's house in peace? Now, we probably won't know until the kingdom the full extent of what was going on as Jacob wrestled the angel. But he did continue to wrestle until he received blessings and more besides. And he now becomes a prince with God. His family was saved, and he did return to his father's house in peace. And God is happy for us to earnestly seek his blessings and to throw ourselves on his mercy. So let's be sure to be grateful when those blessings are granted. Okay, we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll continue our exploration of angels by observing how they interacted with Jesus. Jacob's great grandson.